Welcome. You are tuned in to another edition of Mountain Song and Story right here on Radio Bristol. I'm your host, Tony Doman, and here on this program, each and every week, I find and feature themes relating to Appalachian culture and folk life, and then I play songs and feature stories all about our topic of choice. I also invite guests on a regular basis here on the show to talk about things that they're doing in and around the region. And today's guest is my friend Clint Holly. Clint is the owner of the Ernest Tube, located right beside of the museum in downtown Bristol, Virginia. He's no stranger to Radio Bristol with his show Pressing Matters. The Ernest Tube is a recording studio in Bristol which specializes in recording artists live and direct to lacquer, or otherwise known as direct to disc. Today, I sit down with Clint to talk about so many great things, including vinyl record collecting, music, and so much more. So please join us for a great conversation. First up, I'll be featuring a few local artists as the music lineup for today's program. So let's get things going with some 49 Winchester.
Thank you.
All right, folks, so joining me now is my guest, Clint Holly. If you are a regular listener to Radio Bristol, you've probably heard Clint's awesome show, Pressing Matters, which airs every Thursday at 6 o'clock and re-airs on Sundays at
3 p.m.
3 p.m., okay. Yes. Your show airs on Thursday. My show airs on Thursday. All the cool shows must air on Thursday.
We're like the dream team.
Apparently.
Tony, Big Lon, Pressing Matters.
Yes.
And then on Farm and Funtime Night, you got Farm and Funtime Night.
Exactly.
Also.
The best programming day, apparently. I don't want to brag.
I'm not going to say it, but yeah, I don't know. It's hard to go up against the Wednesday lineup, though. They're pretty good, too.
Yeah, well, really, the whole programming lineup is incredible here on Radio Bristol.
It is.
We'll throw that out there. But welcome, Clint. It's so great to have you on the show today.
Thanks, Tony. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so I know you've been on here a lot, and of course, you just mentioned your show, Pressing Matters,
mm-hmm.
but let's remind listeners a little bit about what the Earnest Tube is all about, mm-hmm. and then we're going to talk about some other things that you are doing. So what's
okay.
the Earnest Tube?
Well, the Earnest Tube is a recording studio, but it's a very specialized recording studio, and what we strive to do is we strive to recreate, we call it the essence of the 1927 Bristol Sessions, where a musician comes in, or musicians, they come in and we use minimal microphones, older ribbon-style microphones from the 30s and 40s, and we position everybody in a room around the microphone, and then we take what they play and we cut it directly onto a disc. And that disc is, it's an aluminum disc, and it's coated with a material a lot like nail polish. And so those are called lacquers. And if you ever hear the word acetate, that's the same thing. A reference disc, that's the same thing. So they look like a record with no grooves when you pull them out of the box. And then when you put it on the, we call it a cutting lathe, you put that on the cutting lathe and it has a sapphire stylus on it. And when you drop that down, it starts to cut a groove. And the music that's being played is fed into that through that stylus. And then in the groove is the music is captured. And so we bring people in, and then we also incorporate new digital technology so people can use it on streaming and social media and stuff like that. So we call it, you know, the essence of the 1927 Bristol Sessions with modern insight.
Yeah.
That's our pitch line. But it's a lot of fun. It's really challenging. And it's just a different way to record it. You're capturing a moment in time, much like a Polaroid picture from a camera. There's no fixing it in the mix or sweetening it up later. It is what it is. And some people really like that. And then some people, you know, they don't want to hear their mistakes or whatever, where other people are like, it adds character.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's so interesting that there's such a resurgence in record collecting right now.
Right.
And your show really focuses on a lot of that, Pressing Matters.
Yeah.
So talk a little bit about the goal of your program.
Well, Pressing Matters, I started that, and the idea I pitched was a vinyl-centric program that wasn't constrained by genre boundaries. It was more about the love of the format itself. And when I started collecting records, I'm going to date myself here. Like, I started collecting records when I was like around 10 years old, and that was about 1982. And right when CDs came in, everybody got rid of their records because CDs were like the new thing, and they were supposed to be indestructible, and the sound was supposed to be perfect. And so I would go to flea markets and I would buy records 10 for a dollar. And like, so as a kid with not a lot of money, it was like my lawn mowing money and stuff like that. I would take that to the flea market and I would come home with like Neil Young, After the Gold Rush, Bob Dylan records, you know, all that kind of crazy stuff. And I would make mixtapes. And it was a thing back then, you know, you would take your favorite songs and you would hook it up to your tape deck, and you would make your favorite thing that you could play in your car or in your bedroom or whatever. And so I look at each show as like kind of a mixtape. It's like my favorite tracks that I've heard in the last week or so, or the records that I just bought in the last week or so. But I also want to add in an element of like telling people more about the format, how it's produced. I like to interview people that are involved with the format. I've interviewed some DJs from, you know, WBCM here. Right now I'm in the middle of this epic interview with this guy named Hank Williams, who was a mastering engineer in Nashville in the early 90s. He worked with like Brooks and Dunn, Alan Jackson, and he started his career as a disc cutting engineer in the 1970s. So we talk a lot about the vinyl format in that interview. And it's just, I call it my love letter to vinyl records. And it's hopefully it's fun. And I always say my punchline for that too is hopefully you hear some familiar songs and hopefully you hear your next new favorite song.
Plus, that guy with a name like Hank Williams.
I know. I mean, I'm sure he's heard that his entire life. Yeah, it's like, I work in Nashville, and my name is Hank Williams.
Oh my gosh.
And yeah, I'm sure he's heard every joke possible revolving around that. But an immensely talented guy, and he worked on so much stuff. It's when you look up, like if you get on Discogs and look his credits up, it's pretty amazing.
Dang.
Brooks and Dunn, Alan Jackson, Shania Twain, Garth Brooks, like he worked on all of it.
Man.
Yeah, he really did.
I really love everything that you do. And you are, the Ernest Tube is located right next door to the birthplace of country music, Museum and Radio Bristol. So we're neighbors.
Right.
Of course. Yeah.
And we kind of, well, I mean, we didn't design it that way because the building just happened to be there when we bought it. But yeah, we love being in proximity to the birthplace of country music museum. And to us, it's just kind of an extension of the same story. We're telling this same story about how, and it's funny, I was just talking to somebody about this earlier today, that like you have to look at the impact of the music that happened here in a broader context, just even outside of country music. It influenced the way we do business in music to today, and in terms of publishing and how that idea's rippled across every other genre. I mean, Jimmy Rogers worked with jazz people, blues people, Hawaiian musicians. Like, it's not a limited story. So we're here to help say, like, Bristol is as important as Detroit or Cincinnati or Nashville or these other cities that have this broad musical history. We have that same thing right here.
Yeah, and you know, something that we like to stress here in the museum when we have different kinds of like presentations, I guess, and workshops, is that music goes beyond the definitions of what genres are.
Right.
So, like, we were joking before we started recording about the genre police.
Right.
Genres were invented by marketing agencies to market certain records to certain people. So,
right.
Like, putting things in a box is so, like, detrimental to...
Well,
music, it feels to me.
If you're a sales guy, you have to do that because you have to know who your audience is. But like somebody like Ralph Peer, and where this Bristol story is so important, is that he recognized that these songs had value outside of Jimmy Rogers singing them. And look at like the Hank Williams the singer catalog, where Tony Bennett sang those songs. Pop singers sang those. Ray Charles sang those songs. So a good publisher knows that a good song transcends those boundaries. And I think that's the real story here, is Ralph Peer knew that the songs that existed in this region had an appeal that was larger than just this region. And I think that's a super important part of the story.
Absolutely. And speaking of that, something that you work towards in all the creative outlets that you're currently doing is kind of getting that story out there to the general public, that there's a really broad reach here in Bristol. So what are some of the ways that the Ernest Tube and your show and all of the other things that you're into kind of help to drive those points to just like your average visitor who's coming to Bristol who might not know anything about country music, and
right.
They come and they see the museum and they see the Ernest Tube and they come visit, and what do you want them to take away whenever they, like your average person, might come to this region?
Well, you know, I've collected country music. I got into country music because I got a box of records that were my grandparents, and the first record that really turned me on to country music was Lefty Frizzell record, Always Late With Your Kisses, and I remember hearing that and I was like, whoa, like, what is that? Like, and it was nuts. But also in that same box was like a Petula Clark record and a Everly Brothers record. So even like my grandparents weren't like necessarily constrained by these like boundaries. And I think that's going to be the thing that we keep talking about here, is like what happened in Bristol. And what I want people to know is like, this is really important. And one of the things I always say to people is America's greatest export ever is its music. And the music came out of a lot of weird things when you think about the collision of African-American culture and white culture in the American South, and that tension and all of the things that came out of that. But then when you look at the music that came out of it, when you look at jazz, gospel, country music, the blues, like those all originated in the southern part of the United States. And it's that tension that helped, you know, make that happen. And the story is sad, but what comes out of it ultimately is really beautiful. And I guess that's what I want people to know, is like, this beautiful thing came out of all these horrible things. And that's really a difficult thing to talk about, because you're talking about 400 years of oppressing people. And then like this beautiful music comes out as like, it's almost like a safety valve. You know what I mean? Like, it's like it had to, or else what else would have happened? Horrible, more horrible things would have happened. So yeah, I think that's a really important thing for a lot of people to talk about. And I see that message coming out. You know, we've recorded people like, we recorded Willie Carlisle recently, and another guy, Nick Shoulders, and those guys are really about opening up the inclusiveness of country music. And I love seeing people like Amethyst Kia become more part of Lil Nas X, making it onto the country charts. Those are really important things. And that's the story that starts right here. So that's the story I want to help tell.
That's awesome.
And it's fun because we get to listen to a lot of music that way.
If you can't tell from Clint's energy through this audio story, Clint is very passionate about music, which is so, like, it just oozes out of you, and it's so motivating. Let's talk a little bit about technology. So, you know, there's this resurgence in people collecting records, and of course what you're doing over at the Earnest Tube is very unique, and there's a place for it here and now, because there's so many people wanting records, wanting to have new music recorded on them, collecting rare recordings, collecting recordings. And why, my question is, why is there such a resurgence right now? And that also reminds me of just how fast technology has sped up. I mean, when we're talking about the Bristol Sessions, which was 95 years ago now, there, during that time, there was literally the wax cylinders.
Yep.
And if you left them out in the heat,
pile of wax.
Yeah. Right. That recording session, that music could have been lost. I mean, we've just come so far, so in a relatively short amount of time in human history, on the way we record music. So,
right.
So is this like resurgence of going back to kind of the old days? Is it kind of because people kind of want to get back to their roots in some way? That's my feelings. But what are your thoughts, and what's your take on why people are so into records right now?
Well, that's a deep question. And that's something, you know, I started working in the vinyl reproduction industry about 12 years ago. And at that point, we were seeing significant increases in people buying records. And I really personally thought it was kind of a fad. And I thought, oh, I'm going to put in 5 years doing this, and then I'll move on to something else. And it really hasn't worked out that way for the better. But a couple things happened. You know, the era of downloading got cut off because of Spotify and all the legal things. And then what people started doing is they would put out a record and they would put the download codes in there so people could download the MP3s. And this is before Spotify and Apple Music got popular with just straight up streaming. And then we saw a bump in people buying the records then, as they would put the MP3s on their device, an iPod or whatever at the time. So they would have a portable format for convenience. Like, music is oftentimes about portability. Like, you think about the 8-track tape that came out in the 60s, the first format that you could take in your car. And then cassettes, and then CDs. So these are all very portable, and obviously a phone where you have basically 95% of the music ever recorded available to you at your fingertips, that's very portable and it's very convenient, but it's also very impersonal. And so I think the thing about records is, I think people that are music fans, they want to support the artist that they're a fan of, and buying a record really right now is like one of the few ways that, you know, especially if you're at a show and you buy it directly from the musician, you are supporting them. And then people, I just think, have this natural desire to collect things. And, you know, like, you don't really pull out your phone and say, like, hey, let me check out this album I just got. But but if you have a record, you're like, check this out. And then you look at the artwork. And then that leads to the whole tactile experience of a record. It's like a ritual. At least for me, it is. You, like, you know, you pull it off the shelf. You look at the cover. Pull it out of the jacket, you put it on the turntable, you put the tone arm on, you turn the volume to where you want, you go sit back for 15, 20 minutes, you get up, you flip it over, you have to interact with it. Whereas like on your phone, you don't. And you just, and then it becomes kind of disposable that way, you know? And so the record gives it more weight. And I mean that like validity. It gives it this like validity that just streaming something on your phone doesn't. And especially like back in the day, you know, the record companies were the gatekeepers. Mm-hmm. If you didn't pass this test, then your music never got on vinyl unless like you were like Big Lon record, the records he collects that were people self-funded those things. A record label would say, well, go back and do some more work and come back, or you're just not good enough to be on a record or whatever. But with digital, like look at how we're recording right here. We could make an album in this room right now if we wanted to. And so that availability of cheap, usable technology, like you said, it moves so fast that everybody can make a record. So now your music is just this very small needle in a very large haystack, and you hope that somebody finds it.
Right.
But at least on a record, people perceive that as a little bit more legitimate, I guess. Whether that's right or wrong, I think that is. But then I definitely see the thing where people, they want to support their favorite musicians. And I think in this day and age, they just really don't know how. Because if you tell people, well, every stream that you stream on Spotify for me, I make 4/1,000ths of a cent.
Exactly.
Like, people are like, what? Oh, I thought you got like a chunk of my $10 I pay every month. And it's like, no, it doesn't work that way.
Right.
And I think educating the general population about that and how musicians kind of are getting the shaft these days. I mean, musicians have always gotten the shaft, but it's really hard for a musician to build any kind of career these days on streaming because the money just isn't there unless you are streaming hundreds of millions of streams. And people like you and I, that's not going to happen.
Exactly, yeah. And I mean, you're right, with the needle in a haystack kind of a thing. And you throw your stuff out there and just hope for the best. And we're living in such an interconnected world. And we have, there's so many great things about technology because I can listen to music from all over the world at the touch of my fingertips, and I can have all these influences, and that's never really happened before. But yeah, it's for the small artist, it's very difficult to make a living like it was even just 50 years ago, 60 years ago. Like all the records we play here on Radio Bristol, and all the music that you know and love, you know, probably was a lot easier, I would say, for somebody like a Hank Williams to walk into a studio and or whoever, you know.
Well, and also, like, I mean, if you study the history of how musicians operated in that time period, you know, Farm and Funtime, the original Farm and Funtime is a great example. Like the Stanley Brothers would play in Bristol for X amount of time until they ran out as many gigs as they possibly could. And then they would go somewhere else and get on another radio station because that would expose them to another audience so they could go. But they also had a captive audience because if you're listening to the radio, well, you don't have a lot of other options. Where now we have infinite options. And that's really what makes it hard for musicians is like, okay, well, if I can listen to an album I'm familiar with or this new thing that I have no idea what it is, most people are going to take what they're familiar with, unfortunately.
It was in summer, back in 58. My sweetheart left me in 88. I said, don't, I don't worry. Oh, I'm sitting on the floor of the world. Work all summer.
Sitting on Top of the World There, version by Zach McNabb. If you are just tuning in, you are listening to Mountain Song and Story right here on Radio Bristol. Today, I am airing a great conversation with my guest, Clint Holly, owner of the Earnest Tube, which is located right here in Bristol, Virginia. We're going to go ahead and get on back into the second part of my interview with Clint. Working on an exhibit here at the Birthplace of Country Music, focused on women in old time music, mm-hmm. and talking about those early barn dance stars.
Yeah,
record producers even made assumptions about the audiences because they didn't always have a way to track right. who was actually listening. So they might think, "Oh, well, I think this audience wants to hear." We're going to portray this woman, this character, this musician as a very, like, hokey, down-home Kentucky girl, you
right.
know? And that musician is, like, almost just they are playing a part. Maybe that right. musician wasn't even from Kentucky, but all the record producers say that this is what the audience wants to hear. So, thankfully, now, a great thing is that we can actually have feedback from our audience.
Right.
It's so much better. We can track that now. But back then, I just think that that's so interesting.
Right.
Producers were like, whatever, we're just going to... This is what they want, you know.
This is what you're going to be,
we're
right?
the ones making the decision. This is what we want, maybe. We don't know what everybody else wants because we can't exactly ask. But.
Well, Minnie Pearl is a great example of that. Like, she was a well-educated, came from a fairly prominent family, and look at her persona. Like, the down-home, mm-hmm. Grinder Switch is where she was from, and she was man crazy all the time or whatever. And that's not who she was, but that's the image that she had. And look at, you know, yeah, so... Yeah, that's the way it went.
Yeah. We were just talking about the resurgence of record collecting. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I run into you a lot at estate sales.
Oh, yeah.
Here around Bristol. I feel like every time I go to an estate sale, I see someone I know digging through a box of records.
Right.
So what do you like most about that that experience? You know, of course, you're this person that's really passionate about music. But when you're not recording music and when you're not... doing the things that you do at the Earnest Tub, why are you into, like, collecting? Like, what's the interest there and the passion?
It's, for me, I use it as a discovery process. And I try and walk into any given situation. I have the stuff that I like. You know, everybody has their preferences. And so if I just see something, like, I used to have this rule where I didn't pay more than a dollar for a record. And so when you're paying a dollar for a record, it's like you look at something and you're like, oh, that's an interesting cover. All right, I'll grab that. Or, man, I've never heard of this. I'll take that. And then you go home and you clean them up and you sit back and you listen to them and you discover. I mean, that's how I discovered Neil Young. I mean, all the things that, like, when I was a younger person, I didn't know what After the Gold Rush was. I didn't know what an iconic album it was, but I took it home and I looked at the artwork and I'm like, yeah, man, I want those jeans and I want, you know, all that. So, yeah, for me, it's discovery and it's the thrill of the hunt. I mean, there is nothing better than, like, going through a crate of records and seeing something that you know is rare or something that you know is valuable, and you kind of, like, look both ways, and then you take it out, and you make sure that nobody else grabs it, and it, you know, it's fun. And I had an experience over, what's the early holiday, Memorial Day weekend. We were at a flea market near Galax, Virginia, and... I found a record that's actually a Cleveland, Ohio band. And the only reason I knew about this record is because a friend from Cleveland turned me onto a reissue of the record. It's a psychedelic band called Purple Image is the name of the band. And the real copies of the record are worth like $200 or $300. And so I'm at this roadside flea market. It's a hot morning. And like I'm going through these moldy, gross records. And I see this album art. And I flip by it and I'm like, whoa, wait a minute. And then I flip back and I'm like, holy moly. And I pull that out. I'm like, hey, how much do you want for the records? The guy's like, $2. He goes, I'll sell you the whole bin. And I'm like, I don't want the whole bin. I just want this one. And it turns out it's a really rare record. So, I mean, to me, I don't want to just go on Discogs and say, oh, I want to own this rare record, so I'll pay $300 for it. For me, I could say, I got mine for $2. Yeah. And I'm a natural, you know, kind of cheapskate. So so to me, it's the thrill of the hunt, and it's the cost effectiveness of amassing a lot of music, you know, relatively cheaply.
Yeah, yeah, well, I can totally relate.
Yeah, of course.
I don't do as much record collecting, but I do a lot of like vintage collecting. So if I'm over, if I'm at the thrift store and I see Pyrex and it's a dollar, I'm like, oh my God.
You're like, you're ready to knock somebody over. Yeah. Yeah, you're piling stuff on top of it.
Oh my God, yeah. But so there's also a really, really vibrant local like music scene here that's growing in Bristol. You all moved from
Cleveland, Ohio, not Tennessee.
I want to say PA, but it's right next to Pennsylvania.
We're close. Yeah.
Yeah. You guys moved here pretty recently, full time. So you were splitting your time up there and down here. And now you've recently moved here full time.
Yep.
And so what's the thought process between wanting to be here full time? Why? And what's the local scene? How do you feel like it is growing with like music, records? What's happening here in Bristol that you wanted to be here?
Well, that's a really good question. I spent 35 years in Cleveland, and Cleveland definitely has its own music scene. And when you look at the influences of music in a place like Cleveland, Cleveland doesn't have, although there's a lot of transplants from places like Kentucky and West Virginia, most of the migrations in the United States were based around jobs. And like, so Cleveland had a pretty robust auto industry, steel industry was huge, and a lot of blue collar union style work. And so a lot of those people came for those jobs. But even like, say, someplace like Akron, Ohio, which is very close to Cleveland, about 45 minutes away, and that was the home of Goodyear Tires. It's the rubber city is Akron, and they have way more Kentucky, West Virginia transplants, and therefore more of that kind of music. Cleveland had this incredible influx of Eastern European people. So like, if you want Slovenian food or Hungarian food or any of that, it is everywhere. But also that music then, polka, those styles of music, huge in Cleveland. And we don't really get a whole lot of that, you know, hillbilly. I don't say that in a derogatory way. We don't have that same hillbilly music influence, where even somebody like Detroit has this huge country music history because so many people came up that side of Ohio from Kentucky. I mean, they even called it, what was it? They used to call it Read and Write and Route 23 is what, like, how people went from, like, that area up to Detroit to get jobs in the auto factories. And so there's this huge country music impact in Detroit, not so much in Cleveland. And so I was such a fan of country music. I always kind of felt like on the fringe of the music scene in Cleveland because it's very metal-oriented up there and art rock and stuff like that. So I always felt just a little bit out of place in Cleveland. So I visited Asheville, North Carolina in the early 2000s, and my first visit to Bristol, I think it was like 2002, and the Birthplace of Country Music Museum, well, this incarnation didn't even exist. It was like this weird little thing in the basement of the mall on the other side of town, and this before internet, before GPS, and I followed all of these little signs, and finally, the last sign points in this parking lot of the mall, and I was like, well, I'm going to go for it and see what happens, and so I go down the escalator, and there's a elderly woman who's manning the little, it's like an old Gap store, basically, with some cases in it and some instruments. So I started chatting her up, and I was like, hey, are there any other places, things to go see around town that are historically, you know, about the music? And I'll never forget this. So she says, she tells me about the monument, the marker on this end of town down here, the Jimmy Rogers Carter family monument, and the murals and stuff like that. And then she goes, where are you from? And I said, well, Cleveland. And she said, Cleveland, Tennessee? And I said, no, Cleveland, Ohio. And she's like, I thought you talked kind of funny.
Oh my God.
And that was my first experience in Bristol. And then when me and Bonnie got together, I said, hey, look, I really love this part of the country. I thought I wanted to go live in Asheville because Asheville is beautiful and it's also very expensive. And so when I got to a point where I thought I could buy property, me and Bonnie or whatever, Asheville is out of the question. So I started bringing Bonnie to Bristol and said, hey, man, I think this has got the history. And then we brainstormed the Ernest Tube idea and to connect to that history. And then we found the building, which is an amazing spot. And then I started my other business, Well Made Music, which is a vinyl mastering business. And then that started generating real revenue. And then we made the decision to buy that building. And then we bought a second building and put Well Made in there. And so now Bristol's our home base.
Yeah. Man.
It's pretty wild, but I'm happy to be here. And oh, and to go back to your music, I'm sorry, I got way off track there, but the music scene here, and people are people no matter where you go. I mean, there's pluses and minuses to every situation that you're ever going to be in. But what I love here is Radio Bristol, for one thing. I love radio, and I love the idea of radio and how it connects people to their communities. I love community radio because it's volunteers that are sharing their knowledge and with the rest of the community, and it's an inclusive, hopefully, situation for most people. And the people like, you know, J.P. Parsons with his show, the Appalachian Travels, where he's bringing in the regional people to get them some exposure. Like, those things all definitely help. And, I mean, Bristol, downtown Bristol on a Thursday night is bumping these days. I mean, me and Bonnie live right in the heart of downtown. And, I mean, on a Thursday night, you could literally go see 3 to 6 bands on any given Thursday night down here. And that continues through the weekend. And, you know, we got the Cameo Theater at what may be around a 500-seat venue. The Paramount Theater at 750. Plays of country music holds what, about 100 people. So we have this nice variety of different size venues, so different artists can be afforded a space to play in, and that's important. Like, you want to see an artist go from the 100 seat place to the 500 seat place to the 750 seat place, and then get too big, maybe then they have to play at the casino when they open up a venue there, you know. So that's the growth that you want to see, is people being able to build up a crowd in any given city. And I think we really have the basis for that to happen here. And if you're an artist, you got good cost of living, you have the ability. I did a calculation. I think within, if you drive 4 or 5 hours in any direction, if you draw a circle around Bristol about 4 hours, you can reach 16 million people.
Man.
Yeah. If you go from like Atlanta up to the bottom of Ohio through like Cincinnati down through Nashville, like, that's a lot of people. And so if you're a touring musician, you can base a tour out of here. I know, having worked in music clubs, I know that there's musicians that drive 10, 12 hours to get to their next gig. If you could chop that down to 3 or 4 hours between gigs, you're saving money, you're saving time, you're saving your mental health, everything. So I think for musicians, it's a really underserved area right now. And I think, I hope that changes, because I want to see more touring going on in this area. And I think there's enough venues popping up. Like, we just met some people from North Carolina. They opened a place called Yonder. It's like a little, almost like farmer's market kind of thing, but then they also have a music venue, and it's a husband and wife team. Ailey Edwards, he played here in the studio of like a month or two ago. And so, like, even those little things, if that helps nurture somebody to get them on the road and get them out in the area, then that's a win for everybody.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah. My gosh. Yeah. And I also looked at moving to Asheville and was like, oh, God, this is expensive.
Oh, yeah. Like, heck no.
So beautiful down there. But, I mean, and then there's also so many, like, record-specific, like, businesses popping up here in Bristol. And you all just had a couple months ago, has it been that long already, a few months ago, the Vinyl Appreciation Day and event. And tell me, like, real quickly how that went and what you see for the future of those kind of events.
Yeah, so we want to do more of that kind of stuff. And so the idea behind the Vinyl Record Appreciation Day was the fact that we saw 2 record stores open in the course of 6 months. Ceremonial Sound up there on Euclid Avenue, which Shane Church runs. And I've been friends with Shane for like almost 5 years now, because I met him as a bartender at one of the local microbrews when I first started coming down here. And he opened up his store, Ceremonial Sound. And then another gentleman, Wyatt Lilly, opened up Cheap Thrills Records right there on State Street. And I'm one of these people that I want to try and go against the human nature that says, oh, God, we got 2 record stores, they're competitors. I want to see a situation where there's so many vinyl fans that 2 record stores can thrive. And each one of them, since I've been to both stores, I know they both have like a little bit different focus also. Like, Shane is very curated. He knows his audience very well. And his store is a little bit smaller, and it's vinyl only. And then Wyatt, he does a little something different. He's got like DVDs and CDs and some memorabilia. And then the vinyl and his stuff appeals to more, I would call it more Main Street, you know, music fans. If you're looking for some classic rock, you know, that kind of stuff, he's got that. So I think there's enough fans around to, you know, support both of those. And then there's these other guys running around town too, the Smokestack Record guys, and they just do pop-up record stores. And so we brought the pop-up guys into the Earnest Tube. And then Wyatt's just right around the corner from us, and then Shane's real close. So I thought, well, what if we did a thing to gain exposure for everybody? We made what we called the vinyl passport, and all you had to do was get the little card signed at each location, and then we gave people some swag, a free record, and then we each store put in some great merch for prizes, and then we had a drawing at the end of the day. Every person that completed it went in the hopper, and we drew names, and we had like 35 people complete the whole shebang. Dang, so that's 35 people that may not have been in either one of these stores before, and hopefully they will go back. And that was the idea behind it. I'm always looking for ways to bring people together, especially when it comes to the vinyl records, because I like, as you can tell, I could talk about this all day. And so, yeah, I thought it was just a really good, fun thing to do. And in terms of what we do at the Earnest Tube, it was one of the most successful things we've done to date. We had people lined up outside before we opened. When I opened the door, I was like, wow, that's cool. And so it shows that the fans are here. They want to participate. They want to be a part of it. So, yeah, I was just thinking about hitting up the Smokestack guys again to see if they want to do something around Christmas time, because it's good for everybody.
Yeah. I'm so glad it was such a great turnout.
It was.
We were out of town that day, so we will be at the next one.
It was a lot of fun. Yeah.
So, Clint, we're running short on time, mm-hmm. but before we go, we haven't touched on the mastering business mm-hmm. you all have and moving that here.
Yeah.
So talk a little bit about that and also the custom pressing.
Yeah.
I wanted to talk a little bit. Tell yeah. people about what that is exactly.
Okay. So my other business other than Earnest Tube, which is another vinyl-centric business, is called Well Made Music. And Well Made Music is 12 years old now. And we're called a mastering studio. And what our job is in the process of making a vinyl record, you have to take the original audio, whether that's on a tape or in a digital file, you have to take that and you have to transfer it onto a disc for it to become a record. And so we use the same material that I explained earlier at the Earnest Tube, these lacquer discs. We put these on a more modern machine. I'll put that in quotes because they're still from the 1970s, but it's the same process. And this one's in stereo and it's much higher fidelity, but we cut the audio into those grooves and then that is sent out to what they call an electroplating facility, and they make metal stampers from those lacquers. So when you think about the lacquer, we cut it and it has grooves on it, and so you could play that on a record player. Now, then when they coat it with the metal and they pop those apart, you have this metal piece, and now that's a negative image. So instead of grooves, you have these ridges on this stamper, is what they call it. So you make two stampers, and then it's like a waffle iron. You put it like in a press, one side of the record, the other side of the record, and then we call it a puck, and it looks like a hockey puck right in the center. And here's a piece of trivia. The labels on a record are not glued on. They're pressed into the vinyl.
I never knew that until I got into this either.
So yeah, the pressure and the heat are so much that it just presses that paper label into the center. And then it moves off and they trim off the edges and then that's a record. So Well Made Music, we do what's called the mastering, and we've done over 10,000 records in 12 years, and it's a cool business, and I never thought vinyl would get this popular. And the reason vinyl has got this popularity is because we touched on this with the tactile nature of records. But people just don't collect black records like they did in the 70s and 80s. Back then, it was the only format you could get. So now people have choices. So when they choose records, they love them in translucent colors. They like ones that have like a splatter effect to them. And there's even a friend of ours named Heath has a company called Wax Mage Records where he hand makes every one of those pucks that goes into the press. They literally use like a hot plate and they make this custom puck of PVC, which is the material, vinyl. That's what vinyl really is, polyvinyl chlorate. And he puts all these colors in it. And they've gotten to the point where we did this one for Kelsey Ray a few years back, where he put pieces of a bandana in the record.
What?
And you can see through the record and you can see the pieces of bandana in the record, and the record plays and the bandana doesn't stick out of the record.
Okay, that's wild.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
And so there's a whole collector community built up around these things where there's people, they don't even care what the music is on the record. They just want the artifact because each one is completely different. And so in any given run of records, you can only make about 25 of those records. So people pay insane amounts of money for these records. But this is a whole another avenue of the collector mentality that we talked about earlier. They want this variety. And there's even people like 49 Winchester is a great example. They just issued their record, which we mastered at Well Made Music, which I'll plug that because it's a great record and those guys are so cool. It came out in like three different colors, and I'm part of the 49 Winchester fan club page, and there's people that buy all three copies of those.
Man.
So think about that as a musician. Don't you want people buying three copies of your record? So if you press them in different variants is what they call them, then there are people out there that will buy all of them.
That's so interesting.
Yeah.
I remember seeing that Kelsey Ray record because I remember seeing a picture of it. I had no idea that those were like bandanas.
Chunks of a bandana.
That's so wild. Wow.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And that they've come up with all sorts of crazy stuff that they do to those, and they're beautiful. They really are. And it's called Wax Mage Records. You can check them out on Instagram. Well Made Music is on Instagram, and the Earnest Tube. We're all on the IG, I guess. And but all those businesses are good for Instagram because it's very photo, video friendly and stuff like that. And I'm too old for TikTok, so it's like I can't
you don't
get
have
down
to on. Jump on every pop.
Oh man, I can't take it. Yeah, I don't have that amount of energy anymore.
It's really really hard to just be engaging online half the time. And I know, like, as an artist or just as any kind of individual, you really have to promote yourself and be on those platforms. But man, I'm like, I have to make this post. Ugh.
It's exhausting.
Like, it's so tiring. Yeah. And then the app crashes. You have to repost it. And you're like, oh my God.
I don't want to do this. You're like, I just want to go back to
bed. I just want to go do what I want to do and not have to market it. Right. You know? But Clint, it has been so much fun having you on the show today. Before you go, you just mentioned a few places where people could check out mm-hmm. what you're doing. Where else can people check out what you are up to? And do you have any events or interesting projects you'd like to share coming up?
Well, the Instagram, I like that for all the businesses because we stay really pretty engaged on that. We have Facebook pages for the Earnest Tube and for Well Made Music. And we have websites, www.wellmademusic.net and the Earnest Tube, www.theearnesttube.com. And we have some great video. There was a guy named Spencer, I think, that made us a video about how the Earnest Tube operates, and it's like follows us through a session. And that's on YouTube. You can find videos, Earnest Tube videos on YouTube under our channel there. And projects in the works. Well, we're working on this great project with the Birthplace of Country Music right now, where we're going to do a podcast about the famous Blue Yodel guitar that is currently on display. So come down to the Country Music, Birthplace of Country Music Museum and check out one of the world's most famous guitars is here in Bristol for a limited time. So I suggest anybody listening, you know, check that out for sure.
Absolutely. Well, yeah, and come on down and check it out because it's here and it's not going to be here forever. So
and it is consistently ranked one of the most valuable, interesting guitars in the world. And it's right here in Bristol right now.
And of course, Clint is talking about Jimmy Rogers' guitar.
The Blue Yodel guitar.
The Blue Yodel guitar. That I had no idea that Ernest
Tubb.
I didn't know that that was the same guitar that he had until I came to the museum and saw that on display. And
Ernest had the guitar for 40 years. They think that the whole thing where he flips it over and it says thanks was his shtick, but that was Jimmy Rogers' shtick.
Yeah.
And Jimmy Rogers' wife loaned Ernest the guitar, and he had it for over 40 years. So, pretty crazy.
Might as well keep it if it's that much of a loan.
Well, that's a whole other story. Okay. Check out the podcast for that, because we might get into some of that, because it's not a sordid history, but there is some history behind why the guitar is here now.
Absolutely. Well, yeah. Clint, thank you again so much for being here. You can check out Clint's show if you stay tuned. It is almost 5 o'clock now. Clint's show airs at 6 o'clock on every Thursday and again on Sundays at 3. And Digging with Big Lon will be on right after this, which brings us back to what we talked about in the beginning of our interview. Thursdays are the best time.
I think so.
One of the best times.
I call it the dream team, the Thursday dream team. So, you know, Wednesday, watch out.
Thanks, Clint.
Thank you, Tony. Appreciate it.
All right, folks, that wraps up today's program. Back before the break, we also heard a great tune from Mama Molasses, so go check her out. Remember, you can catch this show, Mountain Song and Story, every Thursday at 4 o'clock right here each and every week on Radio Bristol. You can also check out past shows if you visit the Mountain Song and Story program blog page on over at listenradiobristol.org. As always, I'll have all of the songs, materials, everything that Clint just said, where you can check out what he's doing, will be posted over there on the blog page. So if you didn't get a chance to write all of that down, go check it out so you can learn more. Special thanks again to my guest, Clint Holly, for taking the time to speak with me today. It sure was a lot of fun. Folks, once again, my name is Tony Doman. Thank you so much for tuning in. I really appreciate it. I've got to get on out of here and make room for Big Lon. Stick around. I will catch you next week. Mountain Song and Story takes you beyond the lyrics of our Appalachian sound and tells the tales and folklore of the people who make up the rich cultural tapestry of Central Appalachia, showcasing influential artisans and traditions through in-depth interviews, music, and storytelling. Mountain Song and Story aims to promote our arts and culture for a greater understanding of the region. Join me, your host, Tony Doman, on Thursdays at 4 for Mountain Song and Story, right here on Radio Bristol.